Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. My answers are posted every week on Mondays, and you can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask me, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Here's a question that's of interest to me, and I could give a long answer to, but I'm going to try to truncate it. Ever since I read Ayn Rand's fiction has not been the same. Her style and works are what I enjoy the most. Yet I still love fiction in general and know that I have many years of reading to come. So tell me the process by which you choose non-objectivist fiction to read. Well, I have a whole detailed process, but I'll give you just some indication. I've read all the objectivist novels of fiction, and I've read as much of the classics I think are indicated by my knowledge of them. I'm getting rid of some negatives, for read generally genre fiction, you know, like detective, adventure, etc. Although occasionally I like one, but I find they're generally too repetitive. So I go to a used bookstore, because what I do, you can't do on a computer. And I ask for the aisle that says general fiction. These books are generally older, but not always, but from the 30s or so on through today. And I then go over them. They usually arrange from A to Z, shelf after shelf after shelf. And the first thing I do is scan the title. It's very important that the title have some interest to me, something that I wonder what's that about. So, for instance, Gone with the Wind is a great title, or a very recent one, Before I Go to Sleep. So I wonder, what do they do before they go to sleep? Enough to make me pick it up. The great majority of titles I pass right by, and that's the end of the book. The next thing is turn back and read the blurb. And a great many books are out on that count. First of all, any prizes that the book won are thrown out and become a question mark of whether it's even worth looking at. Any quotes from other authors are thrown out because those are one friend, helping out another. As to the content of the blurbs, I throw out anything that involves political correctness, minorities, of which a huge number are, or science fiction, which I regard as grotesque. I throw out all serial killers and stuff about the evil science, all that kind of stuff. But it does not have to be philosophically something that I agree with. It can be anti-objectivist, as long as there's some aspect that I find interesting. For instance, Les Miserables is an example. It's not an objectivist novel. Dostoevsky is certainly not an objectivist novel. So if the blurb is okay, then I read page one only. And the simple question I have is, can I read this without difficulty? I could tell that on page one. It's either the kind of style which, have no problem, or it's a style in which you have to concentrate, and you don't exactly see why one sentence follows from another. There's little breaks in focus required. As soon as one page of that, it's over. And at that point, I buy it, if it gets to that point. Because my idea is I don't go to the bookstores that often. So I'll buy if it survives the page one test after the title and the blurb. And I take a stack home. I may buy 20 or 30 in a couple of hours. And then when I get to page 2 to 5 to 10, whatever, I throw out about half of them. But I keep some significant fraction, and a few I find, and I quit. I throw them out when I find they're no longer any good. But some of them you can get right to the end and like it and say, wow. And then I go back and read everything previously done by the author. And of course, some of the things are not that good, but some are. So it's like a continual chase. I have more ways of doing it, but that's the best I can do. If you could ask Aristotle one question, what would it be? Well, I guess it would be, do you know how great you are? How revolutionary your ideas are, not only in your own time, but what they will do throughout history, and that you are the only champion of Greece that will revolutionize mankind thereafter. And I'm sure his answer will be something like, oh, that's very overstated. I'm a methodical, conscientious, logical person, but I'm not the only one. Look at Euclid and all the other Greeks around me. True, I disagreed with Plato on many things, but he's not a destroyer, etc. In other words, I think he would be innocent and would have to be at that stage and take his achievement as every great discoverer of truth takes the truth as obvious and is baffled that other people don't see it. It's a kind of mental process. The one that arrives at it has a way of cutting through everything else, and the rest of mankind has to be shown it. So I think, in essence, Aristotle would agree with Ayn Rand when you said, when I used to tell her how great she is, and she'd say, no, I'm merely intelligent and honest. But it would be interesting to ask him, is it rational for a couple to play hard to get? Is it a good way to test each other's love? Well, as you word, I would say, no, it's not rational, and no, it's not a good way. Now, hard to get in any rational sense would be, you have high standards. You're demanding of what you want in a girlfriend, in a love life. So you don't jump her on the first date. Then you would be easy to get. But it doesn't sound to me like you mean that, because it's a much better way to put it than play hard to get. I think when you say that, you mean if I pretend, notice you use the word play, if I pretend not to be interested in her, when in fact you are, but I put on this pretense in order to suck her in, make her see how much she has to work to get me, how valuable I am. Now, I don't think there can be very good motives for this. I think basically it has to be a fear of rejection. If you make the first move, she'll say no. So you're going to be, quote, hard to get and let her be the initiator, which is not a motive of self-esteem. And or it might be a quest for power over her. If she's the one appealing to you, coming to you, trying to capture you, then you have the upper hand, you think. Maybe you don't know what to expect of her, so you'd rather remain passive and let her overpower you. Now you say, is it a good way to test her love? Well, that means, is it a good way to test her ability to put up with an inexplicable behavior? There's no reason, as you state it, you're putting on an act that isn't true. Instead of meeting her in some amiable or cordial, friendly way, you're being haughty and snooty and saying, now if she loves me, she'll accept even that. If that's what you take as a test of love, you're in the same camp as Tertullian. Now, you know, Tertullian was a church father who was asked what he thought of Catholic dogma, and he said, it is certain because it is impossible, it is believable because it is absurd. And the idea was, if you are a true Christian, your faith so supersedes reason that even if it makes no sense, especially if it makes no sense, you are eager to accept it. And you seem to be saying, if she will put up with the unintelligible in you, that will show that she really has faith in you, which would be faith and not reason. Now, if she's a decent person, and she really does want love in her life, and she has any perception, she will see soon enough what your pretense is. So I think it's a dishonest policy. Of course, I don't know exactly your context. If you mean she has to look your way at a bar before you look at her, then I'm not commenting on that concrete, but I'm taking what you say as overall policy. Did Ayn Rand deliberately keep her accent to force people to concentrate and focus, to work to understand her? No. absolutely not. She did not like her accent. And I watched her trying to retrain herself on certain key words. For instance, the word think, she found as Russian the TH th, as very difficult because her natural tendency would be to say zinc. But she worked on that. But in general, a new accent is extremely difficult to acquire if you're not a linguist and you don't have a great deal of time and effort and socializing to try to perfect it. Ayn Rand obviously had none of these, no time, no money. All of her time was writing. She had no career goals that required it. It is true, you know, that it's a tremendous amount of work to get another language if you're brought up in one. For instance, in French, there are two sounds for E, which when French people say, I cannot hear the difference. But to them, it's obvious. EZ versus ET. Or for instance, the Japanese cannot hear the difference between L and R. So it's not a matter of sitting down. It's harder in a way than learning a new language, and you don't do it unless there is a reason to do it. So she wasn't in love with her accent. If somebody would say, you know, have this piece of bread and you won't have it, she would certainly gulp it down. The idea that she's trying to force people to focus is absolutely fantastic. I mean, what if I say, I cultivate a stutter, so you really work to understand the podcast. Or I'm taking snuff and sneezing in the middle of sentences, so you really have to work. I mean, that is ridiculous equivocation. Focus on content does not mean try to get around obstructions that make it difficult to follow the content. Can the destruction of evil be rationally pursued as one's primary creative work? No. Destruction is not creation. At the end of the destruction of evil, you have the absence of evil, which means you have devoted your life to producing a zero. Now, of course, when necessary, and when you have the time and effort, and when you are confronted by a form of evil that is jeopardizing your values in your life, then it is absolutely important to devote your time to destroying it or defanging it, because under those circumstances, creativity is essentially impossible. But the point of that is to liberate yourself from evil so that you can go to the thing which really is the primary, which is creation, not destruction. The creation of something of value. So that destruction is never the primary. A good example of this is the Count of Monte Cristo. I remember Ayn Rand telling me how disappointed she was because in the beginning, he was so heroic to escape, and then the whole rest of his life was devoted to destroying the people who had been so evil to him and had nothing positive as a motivation or to show for it. She was very, very angry at that book when she got to the end. Now, you might say, what about the police and the army? Aren't they primarily concerned with the destruction of evil? No. They are primarily concerned with the protection of the innocent. And as a means to that, they have to arm and destroy the evil. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.